welcome friends, fans, and colleagues. This is Karen Tate, and you're listening to Voices of the Sacred Feminine Radio on a special Saturday show. And that snippet of music opening the show was by those wonderful Reclaiming folks. They have a CD out called Fireside Chants that's about raising energy, especially for activism. And the one you were listening to was called Sweetwater. So if you or your group are looking for some great chants to do a spiral dance or raise energy at a ritual, look for the Reclaiming Fireside Chants CD. I think you'll be really happy with it. I play their music here, more often than not. And again, welcome to today's special Saturday show. It is my great pleasure to have with me Jo Carson. You probably recognize her name. She's been a supporter of the show for many years, and she's got a body of work out there, Dancing with Gaia, Celebrate Wildness. If you're a show regular, you've heard her commercials here. We're going to be talking today about the history and relevance of the Feria tradition. That might be something new to you. I know it was new to me when I first discovered it a number of years ago. We're going to talk about the history and relevance of this tradition. We're going to talk about the founder, Fred Adams, and since we were going to do a weekend doubleheader wherein tomorrow we were going to actually experiment and do something different. We were going to actually do a Feria ritual on the air, but we're going to have to postpone that for a bit. So today we're going to talk not just about the Feria tradition, but we're going to talk about what a Feria ritual would look like. So you still get a little taste of the ritual aspect, we're going to introduce you to Feria to begin with. And the perfect person to do that is today's guest, Jo Carson. She's an author and a filmmaker. She's a woman who wears many hats. So, Jo, welcome to the show, and tell us a little bit more about your work out there in the world, because I know it's been quite extensive.
Thank you, Karen, and good morning. It's a pleasure to be on your show today. I would like to just kind of put a little context around my involvement with Feria, which is that it was introduced to me by a mutual friend who knew Fred Adams, who was the founder of Feria, named Coke Runyon, who is the leader of the Church of the Hermetic Sciences, and I had been part of that group, and he thought that I would enjoy meeting Fred. Svetlana, his partner, so we went over to their home in a long time ago. This was in 1970 or 71, and I was enchanted to see for the first time in my life a home that was completely devoted to the goddess, and everything that you could see, all the walls were covered with murals and pictures of the goddess, and there were icons and symbolic statues and paintings everywhere, and meeting, these two people who had devoted their life to the goddess was really something new for me. I hadn't heard of the concept of the goddess, and I came to understand over a period of time that this was something that I really cared about. So it changed my life, and I went on to make two films centered on Feria, and one being Dancing with Gaia, which you may have heard about on this show. And then I wrote a book called Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Feria Path, which is available on the feria.org website. And so really my life has been very much influenced by this initial meeting ever since then. And although I've gone on in the film world as a professional camera person, working for Lucasfilm and many other Disney large film makers, my passion has always been around Feria. So I think that gives you generally a flavor of where I'm coming from. Yeah.
OK, Okay. All right. Thank you, Joe. Well, first, let's talk about what is ferropharia. So my understanding, and you can always correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, because I want to make sure I get it right. Ferropharia is a new contemporary tradition, yes?
Yes. It's new in the sense that it wasn't existing in ancient times as that. But, I mean, it was actually started in 1956, which is not really new, you know, now. So it goes back a ways.
Okay, but, you know, a generation as opposed to hundreds of years or
right.
Or longer. I'm wondering, do you know, Joe, what inspired Fred Adams to start ferropharia? I mean, how is it different from your average Celtic tradition or, you know, your other pagan tradition that he felt he had to start a whole new path as opposed to, you know, worship goddess or the earth within another pagan tradition?
Right. Well, one thing that is important to mention is that in 1956, there weren't other pagan traditions. There weren't. There was Gerald Gardner's witchcraft, and, you know, an argument could be made that maybe the Church of Aphrodite was still going in New York, but that was a very monotheistic church, and so even though it was dedicated to Aphrodite, it wasn't pagan in the sense that we think about these things. And Fred had been reading, like, The Great Mother by Eric Neumann and some of these other books, you know, of Margaret, I forget her name. She wrote a lot of books. She was an archaeologist, anthropologist, Adler, I think her name was. And she, you know, had written books. So Fred read them very, very widely and amassed this huge library. But at the time, it was just kind of interest, and then quite unexpectedly and without the use of any, you know, drugs or consciousness-altering substances, suddenly one day when he was at college, he had this profound experience that rocked him in a physiological kind of physical method. Like, it just went down from the bottom of his feet to the top of his head. And he had a vision, you know, of the goddess as being the center, like the source of all being. And, you know, the quality of that experience for him was very joyful. It was very, like, profound and earth-shattering. And he kind of walked around in a daze for a while afterwards, and the whole thing basically changed his life. And he really felt like he wanted other people to be able to experience this experience. And probably what made it really resonate for me was that probably only maybe a year or two after I met Fred Adams, and I don't know how these things are related, right? Again, without any drugs, I was like literally lying in bed, you know, maybe spaced out. I don't remember if I was asleep or awake. It definitely wasn't a dream. But I had kind of a similar experience. It was like this experience out of nowhere, unexpected, unprepared for, of what I could only call the laughter of the gods. It was this huge, joyful experience in my body. And I didn't feel like I was afraid of death after that for a long time. I am now. Now I am. But, you know, time fades things. But it gave me a feeling of understanding what his experience was, even though he had different words for it than I did. I felt like I got what he meant by that. And he felt like that his experience was like, everybody should be able to have access to this, and everybody should be able to live in this sort of blissful state, at least at times, you know. And a lot of what ferropharia about is helping people re-access and maybe create here on Earth a more paradisal form of existence than what we have now. So it's very future-oriented. You know, it's not about just resurrecting old religions from the past, like Celtic approaches or Greek approaches. It's definitely about creating a future that's positive, you know, taking into account all the dreadful things that are going on Earth right now with climate change, which was very much predicted by Fred back then, unusually, you know, for his time. And so,
okay.
Yeah, that's what's the key thing that's different.
Now, say again, was this in the 50s? Is that when this idea hit Fred? Okay. And how long was it before he actually created a group and came up with a tradition and how to do ritual and that sort of thing? And do you know if, you know, did it come out of his imagination? Or who knows? I mean, it could have been divinely inspired. But, I mean, were there any other it doesn't sound like there were any other groups out there to inspire him. So he had to come up with this out of whole cloth, right?
Yes and no. Let me just kind of answer your questions in order. He did have friends, and one of his friends who may be listening now is Jonathan Beggs. Jonathan and he worked together, and they created something the next year called the Hesperides Fellowship, and Hesperides, of course, means paradise. And so they created a paradisal fellowship, and, you know, they had other friends. And my understanding is that there were a number of them that lived in kind of a group home in Sierra Madre Canyon. I've seen photos of this, and, you know, sure enough, Fred covered the walls, you know, floor to ceiling with fantastic imagery of, you know, people living in a paradisal environment. And he's quite the artist, you know, and so his art went through a lot of phases, and the particular house was covered with this particular form of art, which was kind of flourishing and seemed to have Polynesian qualities. But these group of people lived there, and my understanding from Fred was that they did create a temple up in the mountains near where they lived, because they lived near the San Gabriel Mountains. And so that proceeded and then evolved over time, and I think around 1959 or 60 or so, he met Svetlana Uterin at the time, and they totally resonated, and they just couldn't stay away from each other. And so eventually, because they were ultimately soulmates, they did get together, although oddly they never married. But they were together when they came up with the idea that they wanted to modify the Hesperides Fellowship into Farifaria with a new name and a more concise sort of outline of, you know, programs. Like they wanted to create a liturgy of holy wildness, was Fred's term, holy wildness. And, you know, what this really consists of is having ways to celebrate the earth and the cycles of the earth, and to consider each of the changes that the earth goes through as causes for celebration, like the changes of the seasons and the different months and even the days of the week. And everything is immensely, it didn't come up, as you say, out of whole cloth. Fred was an amazing researcher, and he also reached out to really the most interesting thinkers of his day. So Max Freedom Long, who lived in Hawaii, was influential on Victor Anderson, is my understanding, with the Polynesian influence on fairies, you know, his version of a pagan approach. And F-A-E-R-I-E, I believe is how they usually spell it, or F-E-R-I, maybe more accurate. So he was in touch with him, and also Timothy Leary, who invited him to come down and joined Timothy Leary in Mexico, where they had a commune for some time. There were many others, Ralph Metzner and various groups. He reached out, Anais Nina, got letters from her. So he was definitely in touch with a lot of the really interesting thinkers of his era. And I wouldn't say that it came out of nothing. Oh, he also considered himself a ceremonial magician, and he did mentor Polk Runyon, who had the Church of the Hermetic Sciences and the Order of the Temple of Astarte, where they do ceremonial magic. So he became, you know, someone who other people turned to for guidance. He was just so erudite. He was so well studied. He knew so much, and he was very modest. I mean, he didn't like ever, you know, try to put out to the world that he was some kind of a master, although he was, but he certainly was modest, and that was part of his charm for me. You know, he wasn't an egotist at all.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. It sounds like this really grew out of a real fertile foundation. So tell me a little bit about Svetlana. The few times I've read a little bit about her, they just they talk about the controversial Lady Svetlana. Why was she controversial?
She was a very passionate woman. I always put them in the past tense because most of them, they passed through. Fred passed away in 08 and Svetlana just 2 years later. She was Russian and she was passionate. She was very, very intelligent, well studied. But she had maybe like when she was a teenager, she had some terrible nightmares that gripped her about death. And so she was kind of occasionally given to panic attacks, and it in some ways grew worse at different times in her life. As time went on, she would get, to be honest, paranoid, you know. I mean, it was like a mental thing, and she took medications, right? So she was definitely in that spectrum. And then there were other times when she was really like the marvelous, charming hostess and, you know, incredibly creative. And, she, you know, she wrote, like, the Farfaria has what we call the nine royal passions, which are the rituals that go with each seasonal change, the equinoxes and solstices and that kind of thing. And so she wrote these beautiful rituals, very, very creative rituals. And, you know, so there was brilliant quality about her, but at the same time she was on the edge mentally. And she did alienate, you know, certainly a number of people who either she reached out to or they reached out to her, but she somehow managed to make false accusations. And I think that I hope that people can find it in their hearts to forgive her because, you know, she wasn't really in charge of herself sometimes. And she, as I say, had this problem with these panic attacks and these undue fears. And that's why she's controversial, because she did alienate people. And I feel very sad about that, because there are many people, I think, who would have really resonated with Farfaria. But then maybe if they happened to be among the people who contacted her when she was during those periods, they might very well have gotten turned off, as almost anybody would if they encounter somebody like that, you know, during one of those phases. And she didn't want to be like that when she was well. She, you know, she knew that she needed help, but she couldn't always stick with her program to keep healthy.
Well, and you also wonder back then, you know, psychiatry wasn't what it is today either. And, you know, you wonder if, you know, maybe she wasn't even properly diagnosed. And, you know, maybe she never really got the right medication or the right treatment she needed for the time. I mean, remember back then they were, you know, doing terrible things to people in psychiatric institutions. I mean, they were still doing stuff like lobotomies. So, you know, and
she
who's
was never
say,
like,
and I mean, and who's?
She was never
I mean, and who's to say?
Yeah.
Well, no, and I wasn't trying to imply that. You know, I was just saying that, you know, decades and decades ago, you know, people didn't have the options of help that they do now. You know, so that could have also, you know, had an effect on, you know, how well she, you know, how well she managed her condition, you know.
Right.
You know, I'm just, you know, along the lines of you saying you'd hope, you know, people would forgive her. So I'm wondering, you know, just the name Farfaria implies that it's a fairy tradition. Is it, or would that be misleading?
Oh, it's very much a fairy tradition. And Fred's point on that was, Farah implies fairy, just the name, right? But Farah is wild, like feral, F-E-R-A-L, right? And Faria, this is Latin word roots. Faria means a celebration, you know, like a country fair or, you know, something like that. So putting them together means celebration of wildness. And but it's fairy in the sense that, you know, like maybe every indigenous tradition from around the world, there's an acceptance of the idea that there are spirits of nature that are alive and conscious, you know, located both, you know, terrestrially in the earth and, you know, in different land features, which we seek out and we make contact with, and also in the stars, in the constellations. It's understood that there are also the great fae or great fairy folk who live you know, or have their being, shall we say, up in the celestial realms. And so when we have our magic circles, we call on the celestial fae, the great fae and the lesser fae, we call them, who are here on the earth and in the features of the land.
So would that be the deities of Farifaria, as opposed to, you know, like an Isis or a Bridget or an Odin, you know, or they're not specific deities in Farifaria?
The main deity for Farifaria, although we make room for like everybody kind of, is Kori. And Kori means a young maiden goddess, from the Greek words or language, K-O-R-E. And we see Kori as being the divine dancer, the magic maiden, the merry maiden. You know, we have a million names for her. But basically, she's a young woman who plays the role of the daughter in the archetypal divine family of the great father, the great mother, you know, the divine son, whom we've certainly gotten familiar with. And now we're making room, you know, for the first time in religious history for a central, you know, centralizing the divine daughter in our spiritual approach. And she, you can see her embodied in like Artemis and Persephone and, you know, Aphrodite and all these other, you know, there's a lot of them out there, especially in the Greek tradition.
So if Kore is the daughter, who would be the mother, who would be the mother and the father deities then in Farisaria?
Okay, so we don't just limit ourselves to one, you might say, aspect of the male or, you know, female deities, the great father, great mother. But generally speaking, Demeter is probably the one that we focus on as the great mother more than any other. Reason being that Demeter, yeah, the story of Demeter and Persephone is central to the Eleusinian Mysteries. And that was a religious approach centered just west of Athens in Greece that was very popular for as an established state religion for almost 1,000 years and as a folk religion for almost 2,000 years. It had a super long history, and it was, you know, for a very, very long period of time, it was the main kind of spiritual slash religious, you know, path for, you know, however many people lived, you know, in the greater Mediterranean at the time. Anybody that could speak Greek and was not guilty of homicide could come there and, you know, pay the fee and get the initiation. And it was so secret that nobody would ever tell to this day exactly what they experienced. But they all said that what they got out of it was that they no longer feared death. And this is like a huge thing to get out of something.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've talked about, you know, it, you know, the Farifaria kind of has a wheel of the year, so to speak, although you didn't refer to it that way. I'm referring to it that way. What would be some of the, you know, the high points, you know, on the wheel of the year? I mean, is there a Samhain? Is there a, you know, a summer solstice? What would we recognize, you know, the average pagan, what would they recognize in Farifaria tradition?
They would recognize all of, you know, all the usual solstices and equinoxes and cross quarters, which, you know, maybe we have slightly different names for it. Often people say Bridget, we'll say oil milk, right, which is the ewe's milk, the sheep's milk. And, you know, we'll say Beltane, right, at Beltane, right, and Lunasa or Lammas, right. We often call the fall equinox harvest home, sometimes so slightly different names, but Samhain is still Samhain. We have one additional festival, which isn't, you know, so common, it isn't with any other tradition, which is repose, and that takes place, instead of on a particular day, it takes place between Thanksgiving and Yule. And so it's a period of time where the earth, and we're kind of in the northern, so if you're in the southern half of the earth, you have to reverse, you know, the seasons, but for those of us who do live in the north, it's a time where your leaves are going down into the earth, they're becoming compost, the seeds are going into the earth and starting to transform as they do, you know, until the springtime when things start coming up again and are reborn. So it's a time to celebrate, well, compost, you know, that moment and or period of time when things go to rest for a while before being reborn. And we, too, allow ourselves to rest and go inward, you know, and a time for study and things like that, more inward.
Right. No, I get that. And, I mean, I like to call it the time we marinate. And, you know, that, I mean, your group actually has a name for it, repose. But I think that's typical of what what the earth is doing at that time. And if we're in harmony and in sync with the phases of the of the wheel of the year, you know, that's when we sort of naturally do that too. So I like that repose. We're getting to a great place to segue into what ritual looks like. But before we go there, just a couple more things about Farifaria tradition as a whole. I'm wondering, is there such a thing as like core beliefs? Or mission statements, so to speak, and is this something that's just in the United States, or is it in other countries as well?
Well, we do have Peter Tromp or Phaedrus in Amsterdam, who has kind of a Farifarian. He's like our sort of Farifarian European main contact. So he's in Amsterdam, and there are other people in other countries who tune in with us electronically. And, you know, one thing that's kind of weird, but, you know, in a way a silver lining with the move to Zoom meetings for our rituals, which we had to do lately because of COVID, we've been able to have, we had a recent online ritual for llamas. And we had a person from South America, and someone from Canada, and someone from Australia. So, I mean, we wouldn't have been able to have those people come all the way over to where we were. They just couldn't have made it, you know, to come to one of our rituals. But because we're doing it electronically, now we can. So, I mean, there are definitely people in various parts of the world that resonate with Farifaria, but we probably have more members in, you know, the U.S. and then specifically California, just because that's where it got started. And I would love to spread Farifaria, you know, and have people, you know, form their own Farifarian circles, you know, with some understanding and guidance on what that means and what it is, of course. But at the same time, I'm not super good at, like, advertising myself. I'm kind of like Fred. To be honest, I really like the public limelight that much, and you know, I'd be just as happy if somebody else did it. But you know, you don't see a lot of people stepping forward that want that role, so here I am. There are people throughout the world. It seems like, I mean, or at least maybe not China and India. I've gotten a few hits, but not very many people that have pursued it. And of course, there's the language barrier. But yeah, for European and English-speaking countries.
So what would be the mission statement or pillars or the sort of foundation of Farifarian belief, I guess?
Sure. So if people want to really, like, read it, they could go to farifaria.org. So that's F-E-R-A-F-E-R-I-A. And so we have our website there. And on the website, you can look at what is Farifaria on the top left. But in terms of like a mission statement, the mission statement is very much about wanting to bring paradise back to earth. And the idea is that, you know, at a certain point in time, maybe, or at least in our imaginations, there was a more paradisal state. And almost every religious tradition that you find, you know, says, yeah, there was a more paradisal state at one point here on earth. And whether that's true or not, it's not as important as the fact that what we're, you know, aiming at is creating something in the future that's far more paradisal than what we have now. It's very future focused. You know, the idea is that if you can't imagine something, if you can't visualize it, you're definitely not going to get it. So there is an emphasis on, you know, like in Fred's art, he would draw pictures of, you know, what does paradise look like? You know, how would it be arranged? You know, what kinds of buildings would there be? What kind of structures would there be? What kind of social relationships would there be? And, you know, what he came up with, the most similar thing that I can say to describe is like eco-villages, if people know what an eco-village is, and there's certainly a number of those out there, you know, where people have kind of gathered together and they've gotten some land and they've, you know, created a housing situation which is not exactly communal, but where there's certain shared facilities and, you know, a lot of chances to get together, but at the same time a certain amount of autonomy, you know, and where they, to some degree, live on the land. And then, of course, there's a real key thing with Fair Ferry about our future ideas of paradise is that really, and then I'm not 100% vegan myself, you know, I'm kind of leaning in that direction, but the idea, the vision of paradise for Fair Ferry is that really people are mostly vegetarian more than anything or vegan because the act of killing another sentient being, you can't do it without having like a wall against your own emotions. You can't be sympathizing with the creature, at least not very much, and still be killing it. And we want to not have those walls. We want to have that open emotional connection to all the living creatures. And so, you know, for that reason, we sort of go towards a vegetarian approach. And so what that means in practice for this idea of paradise is that there's a lot more fruit trees and nut trees and, you know, like vegetables that grow like beans on vines and things where, you know, you can pick them, but you're not destroying the actual living thing itself. That's the perfect thing, because especially with the fruit trees and the nut trees, it's like they survive because they create these parts of themselves that you're supposed to be able to consume, and then that's how they, you know, propagate themselves, is by creating these fruits and nuts and so on. So, yeah, that would be – and also it's a very easy way to live, is to be surrounded by, you know, the plenty, and of course, in a tropical paradise, or semi-tropical, I guess. I don't like too much heat myself. Personal note. It's like you're going to have a sense of being able to live on the land without constantly engaging in the sweat and the toil.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, for lack of a better term, and, you know, and I don't mean it any Christian connotation, it's almost a Garden of Eden, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, paradise. You know, all right. So, you know, since we're not going to be able to do the ritual tomorrow, and, you know, as you and I discussed, you know, maybe we'll try to do it at a time in the future. Tell us what kinds of things you would do in a fairy ritual.
You know, it depends on the moment, because a lot of our rituals are related specifically to the season, and you're celebrating maybe the change of the seasons, and sometimes it'll be, you know, more specific than that. I mean, there's a series of rituals that have to do with celebrating the day of the week, and each day of the week, as people are usually aware of, you know, Monday is Moon Day, and so on, you know, each day has a particular god or planet that it's associated with. So there are rituals that honor those goddesses and gods according to the day of the week. If one has time to do those rituals, those are mini rituals, and one can do them just alone if they like to. That's fine. And then the months are lunar months, and they go with this idea of that there's this circle, as you say, the wheel of the year. And on that circle, you can map out, you know, the lunar months. But we have a system which was actually called OAM, or OGAM, some people call it, but OAM, O-G-A-M or O-G-H-A-M, Celtic system. And that was popular like maybe around, you know, 150 or 250, you know, CE, Common Era, till maybe 450 CE. And that one... I'm sorry, I got a little distracted. 450 CE. Oh, yeah. So it was a language, and it was a language that people used. It had an alphabet, and they wrote on stones with it. And distraction just comes in sometimes. It just does. Anyway,
So the language somehow translated into a ritual.
Right. So there's a month. Each one has a tree name that goes with, and the tree was doing something special during that month. And so that system of months is part of our series of celebrations. So there's certain qualities that go with each month, and each month has certain, you know, like flavors, you might say, like archetypal flavors.
Okay. All right. And so why don't, you know, as far as, you know, a ritual. I mean, you know, those of us that, you know, are pagan, you know, we know about, you know, calling in the corners, invoking the goddess, you know, setting your intention. There's some sort of ritual action. Then, you know, you thank the goddess, invite them to leave, you know, if they will. I mean, is that the typical format of a Farifarian ritual as well?
Right. It's pretty much along those lines. You know, the central part of the ritual might be to see the goddess, like you do a trance to see the goddess in the wilderness realm, or you might be seeking the advice of ancestors or, you know, the beloved dead. You might be doing healings or calling up the elements, like with a rain dance, or blessings, like a baby blessing or land blessing. You could be doing a marriage rite. Or an initiation, you could do, like, our whole earth initiation is a rite for the, you know, the beloved who has died. We might be doing sacrifices, such as the, you know, fruit juice and flowers, never blood, we never do that, but, you know, sacrifices to the deities for various reasons. You know, so there's a huge variety of kinds of what you would call the meat or central part of the ritual. And of course, you know, as I just mentioned, these other, you know, time-related ones.
So tell me about a henge, Joe. I know you've mentioned, I've heard you mention a henge before. I'm not sure everybody knows what one is. Could you explain that, and how does that play into a ritual?
So ideally, people can build their own henge outdoors. And it's like if you think about Stonehenge, right, that's a stone circle. And there are many, you know, Stonehenges made of stone in throughout Great Britain and in fact, the entirety of Northern Europe. And a henge, literally the word is like very similar to the word hinge, and it means kind of the same, like the hinge that the universe hangs on and goes around. And so when you create one of these stone circles and call it a henge, the idea is that you're creating a space that while you're in it, your universe is hanging on that central point, that center of the circle that, you know, around which at that point, while you're in it, you're kind of beyond time and you're doing something that relates and can reverberate out into the entire, all the layers, you know, of being. And what it physically is literally a set of stones, and you can set one up by, you know, sussing out where you want your central stone to be by looking at the landforms around you and figuring out, you know, what feels like the best place, and then using a compass to go ahead and set up the north and the south and the east and the west stones and all that. And ideally, the hand should be at least 9 feet across, because you kind of need at least a little space on the inside so that you can do your rituals and have a space to have your altar and the temple with your elements represented on it.
So it's a stone circle, or correct?
Or wood circle, or yeah, it doesn't have to be stone. It can be, you know, any natural element. The Fred's original first one that he made was made out of these wood. What they called them menhirs. They were hard to describe a little bit. There's photos of them on the Farifaria website, but basically an upright piece of wood that is in the ground, and then it has a cross piece at the top, and then a pair of like moon-shaped pieces on either side of the top of the cross piece. And it gave you a place to put, you know, little offerings and flowers and decorative things like that, which is always fun. So yeah,
okay.
It doesn't have to be stone specifically,
but it's a circle. You know, is basically the intention with. It sounds like at least a marker to sort of, you know, delineate the circumference or something.
Yes. Yes, you want to have your markers at the north, the south, the east, the west, the northeast, the northwest, and so on. All the eight, you know, directions should have, you know, a marker of some kind showing where it is. It can be temporary. I mean, you can take some stones with you and create one out in the woods, you know, and then take them home with you if you really want to. I mean, it doesn't have to be permanent. It's nice if it is, because then you set up kind of an ongoing relationship to that spot.
So what is the sun door and the moon door?
We open the sun door and moon door at the beginning of every ritual and close them at the end, and they refer to time. So the sun, of course, creates our relationship to the sun, creates the solar year of 365 days. And that's one aspect of time. And then the moon door is the lunar months, of which there are approximately 13 that fit into the solar year. And the moon door, it also relates to like all these things, like the cycles in general of time and women's menses and, you know, other important aspects of cycles, right? Like things that grow and die. So when you go beyond those, when you open those doors, which sounds something like this, moon door, ash and alder, cross with willow, open, revealing silver celestial seas of the mystery night. And then you, with your arms, gesture that you've opened that door, and then you take a step forward. And then usually we have a priest who does the sun door. And then we take the other step, and now we are within the space of the sacred circle, and you're beyond time at that point. You've gone through that door, and behind you now is, you know, the world where time applies, and now you're in this thing called the Pleroma, which is this larger, it's hard to use the word space when you're beyond time because they're connected, but in this larger space that kind of is seen to include time, but that time is sort of a subset of it. It's larger than time. And that's where you are when you're doing ritual.
So let me ask you, it sounds like the woman controls the moon door and maybe the man controls the sun door. Would that say priests and priestesses, if that's what you call your leaders, are they equal in Farfaria?
Yes, they are, and in the same sense that the goddess and the god are considered equal, but somehow the goddess still has primacy. She's understood to be the birth giver and the originator. There's a lovely story in The White Goddess by Robert Graves, which is kind of an old book, and people should understand that the White Goddess refers to the moon, so it's not a racial thing at all. It's just the moon. And she's understood to be your enemy, and she dances, you see. She's out in space, beyond space-time. She dances and she creates a wind from her dance, right? She makes this circular motion in the wind. She takes the wind and rolls it in her hands. She creates a serpent out of it and magically becomes a serpent herself, and they couple. And then she lays an egg upon, you know, the deeps, right, which is kind of the waters, which somehow exist. And so then, you know, she encourages him, and he keeps this egg warm, and then the egg hatches it, and it is now the origin of the universe. This is like the Big Bang. So so they're together, and yet she was somehow there first. And so there's this feeling of the primacy of the goddess in Farfaria. And yet, you know, we honor all the gods. I mean, Dionysus is one of our favorite, absolute favorite gods. I mean, you know, they're all, there's a lot of wonderful gods
out
there.
I get it.
Yeah. Yeah,
I get it. Yeah, yeah, I totally get that, and I definitely agree. So I understand there's such a thing as the four rivers of Fairy. Does that refer to the four directions by chance?
Yes. In an ideal, you know, we always have visions of what could exist, and I don't actually have an altar like this. It would be wonderful to have a, like Fred made, you know, artistic drawings of this. You know, a large flat stone, like coffee table size almost, right, with slots at the edge, at the corners, which would, you know, then you could pour, you know, your juice or your sacred sparkling water from the, you know, earth, from a waterfall or wherever you got it, onto the altar, and then it would pour out the corners, and that would sort of go in the four directions. And, you know, these are like a primal image. And it's very powerful to do that, I should say, by the way. I've poured out waters onto stones before, like big stones, and you would be surprised how powerful that is. Milk, too, it's amazing. That's even more powerful. Anyway, so these four rivers, it's like this idea that in paradise, and this is, there are a lot of you know, religious traditions that have this idea that there was a paradise and that there were four rivers that came out of paradise. And some people say that it was the Tigris and the Euphrates and the Nile and the Ganges, I think, was the other one. You know, but different people have different ideas on which is basically there are four huge rivers. And although they didn't actually meet at a common, you know, place at the beginning of them here on Earth, the idea is that they meet in the heavens somehow. And when we talk about that, it's to refer to this idea that in the world of fairy, which is kind of a more idealistic world than the physical world that we live in, that things are connected, right? It refers to that they would all go eventually to this ultimate round river that is outside of being and circles being, and that it's a river of consciousness, that this river of consciousness envelops and holds everything in it.
Okay. That's a beautiful thought. I mean, I could see that visual of, you know, when you pour the liquid and it goes in the four directions. And, I mean, this is all lovely. I love the birth of the universe with the egg and all of that. So at the center of your ritual, you have something called the ground star. So what is that, and does it have something to do with invoking the goddess, or?
Right. So picture that, and this, by the way, could take place indoors, especially if the weather is bad, you know, and you don't have any choice, or you don't actually know of a place to go outdoors, or maybe you want to be naked, as an example, and you don't want to do that outdoors, obviously, because there might be people. So, you know, and that's an option. It's certainly not a requirement, but, you know, there's always the thought that, you know, as free wild beings, we shouldn't necessarily have to wear clothing. Okay, so so you have your sacred space that you have created, right? You've, you know, called in the great fae and the lesser fae, and you've called the goddess and the god and the elements, and now you've created your sacred space, and you've, you know, said about the four, you know, the four rivers of fairy. So then you have your circle, and everybody lies down, maybe on a blanket or a large set of blankets, with their heads together and their bodies, you know, out towards the different directions in the circle, so that if it was looked at from above, it would look like a star, right? Because, you know, the heads are together and the bodies are kind of flowing out in all the different directions. And there would be a bit of touch, you know, maybe their arms would be out a bit and the hands might touch lightly or their feet might touch lightly. And so they form kind of a star as you're looking down at them, and that's the ground star. And then in that maybe semi-darkness that you have the room right now, someone leads a trance where, you know, there might be a grounding, and you imagine that you're connecting with the center of the earth, and then you're connecting with the stars, and then you, from there, travel in your imagination to a place that's very well known to the group, where they've been physically, like out in the wilderness, right? They've gone to a particular place as a group, and they've learned that place, every stick and stone of it by heart. They know that place very, very well. And so in their imaginations now, they're traveling, and I've done this many times. You know, you travel in your imagination to this new location, and while you're in that location, you would see in your imagination that the location has, like, say, statues of the goddess, which then come alive. So you have the goddess in her epiphany. Now, what is an epiphany of the goddess? It's where she becomes alive and she is present for you, and you have this experience of meeting and connecting with, you know, it could be the god, but for us it's often the goddess, connecting with the goddess. And, you know, she might very well have a message for you, you know, and it might be something you get on a visceral level. You know, it might be that sense of bubbling joy that I talked about earlier in this show. And it might be mm-hmm. a specific message like, yes, by all means, marry that wonderful man that just offered you to marry, you know, or something. You know, it can be anywhere on that spectrum. It
right.
can be, take that trip that you've always wanted to take, or, you know, yes, immerse
yeah.
yourself in the stream that's right next to where you are, whatever it is. You know, you're seeking
right.
maybe advice or wisdom, and so that's what you're there for.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's sort of oftentimes a typical part of a guided meditation journey. So then, you know, after you do that, you guys have something called a communion. Is that different than, like, maybe bread and wine that's shared at some pagan rituals?
It's not that different. We call it the aval, A-V-A-L, communion. It has to do with apples specifically, but apples used to be considered like, you know, generic fruit. It does not have to be apples specifically. It's whatever is in season. And we would do this part after we've come back, right? So we're back now from our trance journey and or whatever we've done on that ritual, which might be any of the things that I mentioned earlier. You know, it could be the initiation or the, you know, baby blessing or whatever. And so we're back now. And so we have usually sparkling water with a little bit of peppermint that's, you know, a stick of peppermint, a sprig of peppermint in the water that you stir into it, which is based on the Eleusinian mysteries. And then there'll be a bowl of cut-up fruit or, you know, apples or berries or whatever, strawberries. And we pass those around as being, you know, like it's what the earth offers us freely. It's not bread. Bread is like from, like, wheat, and you have to really till the soil. It's really different in terms of the relationship of how you get it to fruit that, mm-hmm. you know, grows on the trees and the berry vines and so on. So, you know,
okay,
what comes
so
forth,
the communion is fruit as opposed to...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's a much better idea, quite frankly. So Joe, believe it or not, it's already been 50 minutes and we have about 10
oh,
minutes
wow.
left. I mean, the time just goes so fast. Let me ask you, what more should we know about Farfaria, you know, in the time we have left? You know, would you like to mention the nine royal passions or I leave it to you.
Okay. The nine royal passions are, I think I intimated, you know, rituals that we do at the seasonal points of the, you know, compass of the sacred year. And each one has a story associated with it, and it's the story of the goddess as she goes through the year, the goddess understood to be the spirit of the earth. And I post those little, you know, it's like a story for each moon month, you know, the Beth Luis neon concepts of the moon months that, you know, we got from the OM, which I was, sorry, but I was a little distracted when I was trying to describe that. But I post those on the Farfaria Facebook page. And so if people are interested in reading those, I just posted the most recent one for September. And it's just that part of this series of the moon month stories that applies to right now. So I try to keep those up every month. I post the relevant one. And that's kind of fun to read. And then let's see, what else is going on that's interesting? Oh, we have the Farfaria, F-E-R-A-F-E-R-I-A, .org website, which has tons, like 150 articles on it, lots and lots of information. And it's a bit of a dysfunctional website. It's very, very old. There is a contact on there. It's not excellent. Sometimes we successfully get messages from it, but not 100% of the time. So let me apologize ahead of time if somebody tries to use the contact and fails. But if somebody is very keen on contacting me, they can just farfaria@earthlink.net. Will get to me directly. And let's see. I want to update people on regarding, I'm sorry.
Well, we'll go ahead. And I'll ask you my question after.
Okay. And I'm very excited about the Farfaria Tarot. Initially, we were going to be doing just these little short version of the Farfaria divination system, which was based on the Beth Luis neon, the OM symbols, and we have expanded it out because it became clear that we actually located in Fred's writing everything we needed to put together the complete Farfaria Tarot, which has actually 80 divinatory meanings in it as opposed to the usual 78. And I'm in progress on that. I've got a working group with me, and every week we meet by Zoom, and we do these trance meetings and explore one of the Fairytheria tarot cards, and we're over halfway through. So I'm hoping that by this time next year, maybe I'll actually have the whole thing available in print as a tarot card system with the cards, and which are awesomely beautiful artwork by Fred Adams, and all the meanings that go with them, which is, has a specifically Fairytherian understanding of how things work based on that the what you would call the pathwork cards, which are as opposed to the major arcana, the minor arcana, that these represent relationships of planets with their particular archetypal personalities to each other. And so those relationships come out in the minor arcana. And the major arcana, of course, has, you know, the more primary meanings that we have for the huge archetypes. So that's going to hopefully, as I say, come out next year.
Well, it seems like it's certainly a well-developed tradition with a lot of depth to it. Now, I know if listeners or regulars, they will recognize the book Celebrate Wildness, which you wrote, Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Fairytheria Path. Is that more or less a handbook that would indoctrinate you or orient you into Fairytheria?
I prefer orient. Thank you.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's meant to be an introduction. And if somebody wants to really, you know, go with what's in there, by all means, they can. It goes all the way up to the point of, you know, providing like a self-initiation ritual, which, you know, some people would say, oh, it's really more of a dedication, but you can look at it that way. But the idea, the reason we call it an initiation, is that you really have to do a lot to accomplish it, including building your own henge. And so that provide you with that opportunity. And if a person has actually gone through and worked their way through their own self-initiation with the aid of the land spirits that will join them, I promise you, in the process of doing this, then they don't have to wait, but they're always welcome to contact us. But certainly if someone's gone through that level and wants to be more deeply involved in Fairytheria, we welcome people who've done that, you know.
Okay. So for folks that maybe want to connect, is Facebook the best place for, you know, the uninitiated, so to speak?
Well, it doesn't provide nearly the overview that you get by going to fairytheria.org. Facebook is like, oh, here's what we're doing right now. But if you want to find out about the background and all the different rituals that are, and I mean, it's not even complete. There's just so much material that I'm sorry, it's kind of overwhelming. We're doing our best here to digitize everything. I mean, there's also the Book of Fairytheria, which is not commercially available, but it's like, you know, closing in on 900 pages long, and it's like everything. It's all the rituals and, you know, the writings and the essays and so on. So that's, you know, an ongoing project because we're adding more and more to that as time goes on. But, you know, people sometimes volunteer to help with that. You know, that's super, you know, we appreciate that a lot. Best way to communicate with me, yeah, I Facebook's a great way. Also on Facebook, we have Friends of Fairytheria, which people are welcome. It's called, I think the term is private, but people can find Friends of Fairytheria on Facebook and then ask to join. And I kind of filter them a little bit. If people, I don't like actually invite people to join if they're members of like 1,000 other groups, because it's like, I'm not sure what they're up to. I mean, no one has time to be in 1,000 groups and not paying attention to them. You know, but if it's somebody that seems reasonable and seems to have similar interests, then yeah, absolutely invite them to join us. And we have a great, great little place to communicate back and forth there. I put a lot of announcements there too.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we close with you telling us what is the next biggest upcoming holiday for Fairytheria?
Oh, that'll be Harvest Home, and it's coming right up. It's the fall equinox, right? And we will probably do a Zoom gathering for it. There's a lot going on right now. It's a whole other thing, outside life. But I'm thinking that we will probably do that. At the very minimum, we'll go out in our own hands here, and do a small ritual, but if we can kind of organize our time in such a way that it permits, we'll invite people and we'll do, like we did on Lammas, we did a lovely, you know, vision of the goddess trance journey on Zoom, and we had a lot of people that joined us on that. And it was really fun. That was the one I was mentioning where we had people from different parts of the world. And it worked out really well. I showed a lot of Fred's art, you know, which is very inspirational around the goddess and so on. So
okay.
That's the next thing.
Well, Joe, it has been fascinating learning more about Farfaria. I mean, I'm so terribly impressed, and I know you know, Fred was an incredible artist. And if anyone wanted to see more of his art, is it out there anywhere?
If you just Google, I tried this yesterday. Google Farfaria, and then go to images, and let's like. Somehow, a lot of his art has proliferated out throughout the internet. It's amazing. I'm surprised by this because I guess in a kind of a technical way, the copyright is really actually owned, you know, by Farfaria. But nonetheless, you'll find a lot of it out there. And you know, as long as people give Fred credit for the art, I don't know, in some ways okay with it. It's a little mixed, you know, as long as they don't claim that it's theirs. But it has proliferated, and
okay.
You can certainly see a lot of it. It's quite beautiful.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Well, Joe, thank you so much for being such a loyal supporter of the show. I'm so glad we finally got you on the show to talk about Farfaria, and I look forward to maybe actually trying that experiment we talked about to actually see if we can do a ritual on the air. We'll have to do that when your schedule permits.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that will be fun.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, and you have a good rest of your weekend, and thanks again for bringing all of this information to our listeners.
Blessings to you.
Bye-bye. Well, that about does it for me today, folks. I want to thank you for tuning into this special Saturday show. I am actually going to be your guest next week. Next Friday, I will be bringing to you the next installment of Goddess Calling, where I share with you one of the messages, the inspirational messages from Goddess Calling, followed by a meditation. And we have a lot of great guests scheduled in the weeks to come. So if you have not yet clicked the follow button for the show page, you will definitely want to do that. And that way you don't have to worry about if you missed something great, because I think all of our guests are providing an incredible path forward for us. You know, as Joe said earlier in the show, you know, if we can't vision something, then we will never manifest it. And I think so many of the guests here on the show do provide us with inspiration for a way forward so that we can create a better world. So, you know, in the archives are an incredible source of inspiration as well. So anyway, click the follow button, and until next week, I'll just leave you with the thought that what you nurture, what you tend to, that will thrive, and what you neglect withers. So be very careful where you're putting your energy. And also, you know, with everything going on in the world out there, I just leave you with this blessing. May Isis embrace you in her golden wings. Thank you very much. Have a great weekend, and I'll be back with you next week. Bye-bye.